Good morning. So last time we we looked over our single cycle processor design, and we talked about sort of extending that design we saw in CS01 to support pipelining, and this was the idea that if we had like instructions A, B, C, we'd have A in the third stage of operation, followed by B in the second stage, and C in the first stage, and in the next cycle, A would be in the fourth stage, B in the third stage, and so on, and we have these kind of instructions, you know, advancing one step at a time in lockstep, and this gave us a performance benefit in that we could actually finish more instructions per unit time, and the reason was we weren't leaving things kind of idle for a lot of our clock cycle like we were in the single cycle design, where, you know, we had every instruction go through all its steps before we went on to the next instruction. We also mentioned that this came with a cost. We had to actually increase our latency, meaning the time from the beginning of an instruction to an end of an instruction. And so this pipeline idea seemed like a great way to speed up processors, but we had kind of two issues we discovered as far as our how our pipeline processor worked that made it less functional than we would like without some additional fixes. One of these was control hazards. When we have conditional jumps, the way our pipeline processor is supposed to work, every time we finish running an instruction, we want to start running the next instruction immediately afterwards. But in the pipeline design, we haven't, you know, actually done all the work of the previous instruction. And normally, this doesn't really stop us from starting the next instruction, but we have a big problem with conditional jumps and things like that, where we need to finish running the instruction to figure out what do we actually run next. And we call this problem a control hazard. And our big solution for this was this idea called branch prediction, or, you know, where we guess. We just guess what the next instruction should be, and we start running it. And we guess the instruction after that, and we keep guessing until we either confirm our guess that the conditional jump gets far enough where we can figure out, oh, it was supposed to go here, and we verify that, that matched what we guessed, or we figure out our guess was wrong, and we sort of undo all the guessed instructions at that point. And we call this undoing process squashing. Then we talked about data hazards. So another problem is that in our sort of pipeline design, we sort of write back results in the last step of instructions, at least write back the results to registers. But we read them much earlier. And this means that a future instruction might read a register that in the single cycle processor would have been written already by a previous instruction, but because we delay our writes to the last step of the instruction, hasn't been written yet. And we call this problem a data hazard. And we saw there were kind of two solutions we talked about for data hazards. One was this idea of stalling, that, well, when we detect this problem, we can just delay the instruction until the value it needs is actually written. And this doesn't cause us to delay every single instruction. We don't go back to our single cycle processor because there's going to be a bunch of instructions which don't need a value that's being written. And we have this second solution, which we'll talk about more today, of forwarding. And that's based on the observation that even though kind of writing back the value is the last step of our pipeline, computing it is often done much earlier. And this means that if we just add some extra wires to our processor, we can send the value from where it is being stored temporarily before it's written to the registers to where it's needed. And we'll talk a little more about that. It's our main topic for today. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, and I prepared a slide about quiz question 2D, and then I read the comments on it and realized that there was another interpretation of the question that, so I just marked it as accepted any answer. The other interpretation being that some people said, so the question said, the machine in the middle could make the server think the client requested different courses. I interpreted that as courses the client never requested, which means the answer is no, because of the digital signature. A lot of people interpreted that as re-requesting the same courses when they didn't, which, in which case the answer yes is correct, would be yes, so we just dropped it. Okay, so let's go back to our forwarding. So our observation when we introduce forwarding is that we have this case here where I have my add into R9, and while I'm reading the register value for R9 in the second add instruction, I'm, computing it in the first. And that means by the time we actually need the value that's read, it has been computed. And so our kind of solution for this was to say, well, we're going to read a wrong value here. Let's just get rid of that wrong value and replace it with the right value that we just computed. Now, we don't want to always do this because we won't always have an instruction that writes something and then an instruction that reads that value. So we'll add a mux to control this decision, and we'll have this mux have logic, which is comparing register numbers from the machine code to figure out when do we actually make this shortcut happen. And we also have the same situation come up in some other cases. So for example, rather than having an instruction that writes R9 right next to an instruction that reads R9, we might have it such that it's sort of two instructions apart. In that case, we can still do forwarding. The value's been computed, even though it hasn't been written to the registers yet. And so we have this other path here that we want to send the value on. So we have another shortcut, which means our mux is going to have another choice, and we have to do more comparisons for this. So this is, simpler conceptually than it is to implement, because this mux obviously has some pretty complicated logic, and we actually need two of them because we're reading two registers. But the basic idea is that whenever we read a value, we're going to kind of somehow search for more recent copies of it elsewhere in the pipeline and use this kind of mux structure to forward them. So let's look at kind of what that means for an actual execution. So here I have a sequence of instructions that we're running on our 5-stage pipeline. And remember, kind of the usual thing would be that we would read values in the decode stage, which is our register read stage, and we'd write them in our write back stage. So if we just let things happen normally, we're going to have some data hazards here. So for example, this add is writing to R9, and it normally that value is going to be written around here. And this XOR needs to read from R9, and normally it's going to read there. So if we don't do anything, the XOR is not going to have the correct value of R9. And so the question here is, where do we not only have cases like that, and if so, how do we resolve them with forwarding? And to resolve these with forwarding, our assumption is we're going to forward to the decode of an instruction. So for example, here, we're saying that in subq, we're going to forward to decode. And the question is, are we forwarding at all here? Or are we you know, option A, not forwarding this value. So I might have that answer for all our pairs of values and instructions. You know, where do we need to use this forwarding trick to get the thing? We can't just read it from the register file. Or we select not forward it from if we think we can just get it from the register file. So I'll give you a couple minutes to figure out what you think the answers for all these are and check with your neighbors that you agree. We'd like some more time. So let's start with the first one. SubQ. In SubQ, R8 is blank from FQ. Who, let's start with A, who thinks it's not forwarded at all? Okay. B, from forwarded to decode from execute. C, forwarded to decode from memory. D, forwarded to decode from write back. And no clue. You no clues. Okay, so a majority of people said A, and that's what I get. So this is something that's here because this is a common point of confusion. Yes, we have a value in common between these instructions, but there's no need to do extra work to get that value from one instruction to the other because, you know, in the case of the add queue, we can, as far as we can tell, we don't know what's above the add queue, but it looks like we can just read it. And in SubQ, like if AdQ could just read it, we can just read it. And if AdQ can't just read it, we should do whatever AdQ did to get it. Which might be forwarding from an earlier instruction that's not shown. And that's because this AdQ writes to R9, there's no, you know, it's never gonna modify R8, we don't need to check it for the current version of R8. So I agree that's not inconceivable to do that, but this is generally not something processors do because the forwarding logic is complicated enough already if we're only dealing with writes. And this doesn't actually save us time because we kind of can't really skip reading the register file anyways, so we're just always gonna do. How about our next one? So in XOR, R9 is blank from AdQ. Start with who thinks it's not forwarded, A. Okay, who thinks it's forwarded to decode from execute, to decode from memory, 2 to code from right back, and no clue. So some no clue, some code from memory. So a plurality set to the code from memory, that's what I get. So in this question, we're assuming it gets forwarded to the code. So I'm going to draw kind of say that we therefore have it going to here. And usually the way I'll indicate forwarding is that we'll say that it's going to the very end of the decode stage. This is not the only way of implementing it, but it's what I'll just do as a choice. And if it's going to the end of the decode stage, we need to get it from our add queue instruction. And our add queue instruction is currently in the memory stage. So that's where that sort of wire is going to go. And if we go back to our diagram here, it is this exact wire here that we're using, that goes from memory to decode. A common thing that sort of people get confused by here is that we're not going to time travel when we're forwarding, which means that even though it kind of makes conceptual sense, that, oh, we're taking a value from execute and sending it to the XOR instruction. Yes, kind of that's ultimately what's happening, but that's not where the forwarding is. You know, the value stays with the stop for the add instruction until we get to the place where we grab it. And that's what the forwarding operation is. And when we grab it, we're grabbing it, you know, at the same time when the add instruction's in the memory stage, we're grabbing it from the memory stage. So questions on what's going on here? Since I know. Okay, so let's start our next one. In AND queue, the last instruction, R9, is blank add queue. Who thinks it's not forwarded? People, who thinks it's forwarded to the code from execute? Who thinks it's forwarded to the code from memory? And who thinks it's forwarded to the code from write back? Okay, so we have a split between A and D. Just write that down and we'll get back to that later. And let's do the last one. MQR9 is blank XOR queue. Who thinks it's not forwarded? Okay, how about forwarded to decode from execute, to decode from memory, and to decode from write back, and no clue? Okay, so our plurality is that we had that for the XOR queue is forwarded to decode, I believe, from execute. And if we think of what's happening, we need this R9 value to go to the XOR, from the XOR queue to the AND queue. And that's because otherwise we're not going to have the right value of R9. It's not written back in time. It would be written here, and that's not when we're reading it. Not in time for us to actually compute the AND. Now, then there's the question of what is going on with the AND queue and add queue. So something we could do is we could imagine forwarding it here. There's a big problem with that, and that's that if we have a choice between these two values of R9, which one do we want? Well, we want the XOR one because it's the most recent available one. We don't want an old value of R9, and so this is going to be A. And that's because, yes, we can get a value of R9 that way, but it's not the most up-to-date one. And we'll always choose, when we have an option, the most up-to-date possible value, because you'd be really annoyed if your program mysteriously saw old values or registers. And if we don't care about the old value, there's no reason to forward it. We're not going to, like, forward it and then discard it. We're just going to realize this and not forward it at all in the first place. Question? Question, after the execute stage, it's already available? You mean from the XOR to the AND queue?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if we look at our diagram, this is what we're forwarding here, right? And that's from a timing point of view, that's fine because it's clearly ready to write to this register. And if it's ready to write to that register with this forwarding, it's, you know, should be ready to write to the other register. If we're thinking about this carefully, we might say, doesn't this MUX take a little extra time? And the answer is probably yes, but it's relatively minor and we'll account for that when we set our cycle time. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So what I showed here is we were doing forwarding, and thanks to forwarding, my pipeline diagram, sort of when instructions were in the fetch, decode, execute, memory, and write back stage, didn't need to change, which is great because our previous solution was stalling, where we had to delay instructions a bunch. Unfortunately, we can't only rely on forwarding to solve our problems. And the biggest issue is that if we have a value produced from the memory stage and then used in the execute stage, well, if we think about, you know, taking RBX here, we want RBX to go to the subtract. The earliest it's available is after the memory stage, immediately at the end of the memory stage, because we need to access the data cache to get the value of RBX, and that's in the memory stage. I'm not going to get the value until then. But that means it's only going to be ready at the end of the execute stage, which is too late to do a subtract, right? So if we think of our subtract instruction, the value is needed for subtract there. And this is with time going, you know, left to right. So that's a problem. And our solution is going to be to combine forwarding and stalling. So stalling, remember, was the idea we delay instructions until their values were ready. So we're going to do that. But rather than delaying it until it's actually written to the registers, we'll just delay it until it's possible to forward. And so that gives us something like this, where we say, well, it's possible to forward when the move gets to the memory stage. We just need to delay the subtract's execute stage to make sure it happens after that memory stage. And we'll use forwarding to actually get the value there. In this case, I'm forwarding from the end of the move's memory to the end of the, you know, delayed decode for the subtract instruction. And the way I've represented this on this diagram is that we're kind of repeating the decode stage when we realize it can't work the first time. But we also need to use forwarding, because if we didn't use forwarding, then we need to keep delaying the decode stage until it actually gets written back. And I guess something I will note about this, if we think about what's happening with the next instruction, that instruction is going to need to repeat its fetch stage because, you know, we can't have two things reading registers at the same time. There's only one register file with one set of things to read from. So questions about this idea of combining forwarding and stalling? Okay, so from this diagram, it might appear, okay, so every time we access memory and use a value, we need to do a stall. And that's not quite true. So it's true here because we need to use it in the execute stage, but sometimes we don't need to use a value until later. So this is an example where even though the value is produced from the memory stage, we can avoid stalling. And this means now we're adding extra forwarding lines that we didn't have before. But most processors which have used this five-stage design have considered this worth doing. So here we're forwarding from memory to execute. And the reason why this works is that we don't actually need to do any arithmetic with RVX in this case. We just need to send it to the data cache as is. But if we think of our diagram here, we're doing something like that. And adding another mux to make that work, and also a bunch of logic to compare things. It's a bunch of work to implement another processor compared to just drawing this picture, but this sort of diagram here is saying, you know, we take the value from the data cache and prepare it to be sent to the data cache in the next cycle. So something you might say is, gosh, if we can forward from memory to execute, why did we actually need to stall here? Couldn't we, you know, have just said, okay, I can draw new wires on this diagram. Here's a new wire. We can draw a wire from our data cache right to just before the math circuit, right? That would save us from stalling if we just added this path to our circuit and muxes to control it. And you can do this, and this processor will be functional. But there's a reason why this is not something we consider a valid way of doing forwarding, and that's because even though, yes, it will compute the right results, it's going to be way slower. We're going to lose most of the advantage of pipelining, and that's because when we do pipelining, we have this goal of having this short cycle time. And how short the cycle time can be is based on kind of what's the worst case for how things have to go through the circuit. And if we think of what needs to happen in one clock cycle here, with this design, in one clock cycle, we need to read from the data cache and take that value and do a computation with it. And you know, in some processors, maybe this is a fine choice to make, but here we've made a decision to try to put our math stuff and our data cache stuff in separate stages. And by adding this sort of shortcut here, we've kind of undone that decision. So this is not a valid forwarding operation. We always end up doing sort of this stalling instead, because, you know, we don't want to make the clock cycle need to have the time to do essentially two stages. So questions about sort of our limitations on making our cycle time get high? Okay, so we've looked at when forwarding happens and when it doesn't. And sort of a terminology thing mentioned is that we've talked about hazards. And hazards are when something will not work kind of in the pipeline before we do something to resolve the hazards. And we've seen stalling, forwarding, and branch prediction as possible ways to resolve hazards. There's this other thing we'll talk about, which will become probably pretty relevant when we talk about out-of-order processors, of dependencies, whether an instruction needs the result of another. And we've seen that dependencies between instructions are kind of a necessary condition to have a hazard, right? That we have this reason to do forwarding because these two instructions, one needs the value of the other. but they aren't sort of guaranteeing that we actually have a hazard, that we actually need to do any extra work, because it might be the case that even though one instruction needs the other's values, the register file just handles that normally. So let's do a little exercise here. Here I have this. So let's think about, in this example here, let's say we're doing our five-stage pipeline, where their dependencies, regardless of whether they result in hazards, and which of those dependencies are hazards that we resolve with forward. And I'll start by sort of going through dependencies. So here, I'll do my first dependency is like here. So this RBX going to here, right, that's a dependency. Right, we need to make sure the add instruction runs and computes its value before we can run the second add, the last add instruction. First one, I'll just number these instructions. Instruction one, value is needed in order to run instruction five. But is that a hazard? Well, if we can run our pipeline kind of in the where we fetch a new instruction each cycle, which probably actually need to look at if there's any need for stalling here, but there's no memory instruction, so there shouldn't be, or conditional jumps, so there shouldn't be any stalling or anything like that. So if I figure out when things are, I can say, okay, well, there's this dependency, but we're going to write the value here, and we're going to read it here. That's no problem. That we're just going to resolve that without, there's no hazard there, it's just a dependency. Okay, so can someone point to me any other dependency that's here? Yeah.
RCX and 4 depends on RCX and 3.
So RCX and 4 depends on RCX and 3, okay. So who thinks this is a dependency that's also a hazard? Okay. Who thinks it's not a hazard? Okay. And I would agree. So this is a hazard, and this is something we'll resolve with forwarding. So we're going to forward probably from the end of execute to the end of decode. How about any other dependencies here? R10 from 4 to 5, okay. Is this, so who thinks this is a hazard? Thinks this is not a hazard? No clue. Most people just no opinion, okay. I would say this is a hazard because we're normally going to write it there and we want to read it here, so we're going to resolve that with forwarding. Any other dependencies? So who thinks there are no other dependencies here? Thinks there are other dependencies? No clue. Okay, so we don't have any consensus or any volunteering good clue. So there are some registers in common, and here. So that might be candidates to be dependencies. So this is a REX between the first add instruction one and instruction two. That's not a dependency because we're only reading those values, right? We need to have a value produced and by one instruction and used by another to have a dependency. The other case where you might think there's a dependency is RCX between instruction 2 and 3. And this is kind of a subtle thing because usually when we have this kind of pattern, it is a dependency and even a hazard, like here, right? We have the destination register of our two instructions is the same each time. you know, and with our two operand instructions, we're used to an x86, that usually means a dependency. Here, this is not a dependency because even though this move is using RCX, it's only writing to it. It doesn't care what its prior value is, so that's not a dependency. And I'm bringing this up explicitly because this is a common point of confusion. People often, you know, want there to be forwarding there because, well, that usually happens when we have an instruction with operands that look like that. But we have to actually think about, does the instruction read this value? And the answer for the move is no, it doesn't care if it's an RCX. Beforehand. Okay, so questions? Here, yeah. Can we have a dependency without it being hazard? Yes, and we had an example of this between instruction 1 and 5 with RBX. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we've so far been showing things with this sort of standard 5-stage pipeline design, but as we kind of alluded to when we talked about sort of the throughput latency trade-offs, we can have different pipeline stages. And this gives us different hazards than we'd have otherwise. You know, because the stages are different. So let's do, you know, an example of this. So let's say I've split up my execute stage into 2 stages. Let's work through where do we have forwarding now. And let's assume that the way my execute stage works is that I kind of have, you know, I previously had this math thing and my rec file, and this is from the code, and I basically just added a register file in the middle, and this means that I need the inputs to the what was previously the one execute stage at the beginning of the first execute stage. I only get the results at the end of the second, like the, I don't, you know, can't take a shortcut, even if it's a simple execute instruction. And yeah. And you can check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what should go on here. And note that we might need to use forwarding combined with stalling, like we saw earlier. And because this has more stages, we're going to have more opportunity for hazards, right? More stages generally means more hazards, because there's more opportunity for instructions to overlap when they might not have previously. Question?
The values are only available at the end of the execute stage.
Question, the values are only available at the end of the execute stage. So if it's an instruction that computes a value in execute, in our normal pipeline, it's only available in execute 2. In this design.
Still. from the water as well as the university.
So let's just start with what happens with instruction two. Who would like more time for figuring out just up to instruction two? Okay, in that case, can someone volunteer? What do you think should happen with instruction two? How should I like complete our diagram for instruction two?
So I would start with F on cycle one.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying we have to stall. So, and what you're pointing out is that this R9 here that we want, it's not been computed yet. So if we just read it normally, we're not going to get an old version of it. And we want to forward it, but if we try to forward it here, well, the result's not available yet. So we're going to need to stall to resolve that problem. So that's us stalling. And after that, we can actually forward it. So questions on... So at this point, now we actually have the value, the correct value of R9 for instruction 2, and the correct value of RBX, hopefully. And this lets us sort of run the remaining stages as usual. So that's one instance of stalling and one instance of forwarding that we needed. So note that because we had a sort of deeper pipeline, we ended up needing stalling more often. So this is telling us another kind of trade-off of making our pipelines deeper. So we talked about one of them was that kind of we had more time being spent, you know, because we had our stages weren't quite even, and more time being spent because of the register writing between the stages taking time. We also have this problem that we need more hazard resolution, which means more time where we kind of have to skip stages because of dependencies. How about let's start with instruction 3. So what should happen there? How should I finish, start my diagram for instruction 3? Yeah.
So F in cycle 2.
F in cycle 2, yeah. So, okay. Okay, so you're saying then you want to stall decode. Okay, and then we have another dependency here?
Don't you need the value of...
So we happen not to have a dependency. Maybe I should have chosen more distinct register names. So R9 between these. So we need the value of this R9.
Oh.
But we don't need the value from instruction 2 because it doesn't modify R9. So we need the value of this R9.
You just forward E2 from the first at Q to the decode for three.
Okay, so you want to put a decode here. So this is something So this would make sense if we had a nicer register file, but we're assuming our same register file, so we have this problem is that we're not accounting for yet, that we need to be careful about, which is that we have a traffic jam here. We can only put so many things there. So even though it seems like nice, really attractive to like decode right away, we can't do that. Yeah, so fetch sort of has to wait for the decode to be available. We could maybe fix this by modifying our processor to have a really fancy register file, but then the question is, what happens next? Then we want to go to execute. Do we have two executes? So we're just gonna wait. And then we'll decode. And as we said, we need to forward the value of our 9, so we're going to do that. But since we delayed our decode, we're going to have to do that from the memory stage of the instruction of instruction 1. Question?
I'm wondering why there's a dependency for 1 and 3, because I would think that it's similar to a move where we don't care what's currently in our 9, and you can just add to whatever.
Question, why is this different from a move? So in this processor design, the addition needs to happen here. Which means that, so we can't use what's, we can't like delay the addition until we're actually updating the register file, because it has to already be computed here, and then it ends up going kind of through and later gets written. So I think what you want to happen is that you'd like the register file to just take a value to add. Unfortunately, that's not how our register file is going to work. Does that answer your question? Like, we could imagine making a register file that way, but I think the decision has been the register file is complicated enough already. We don't want to add functionality to it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so then we'll have this instruction continue with its stages. And I guess I'll go through my worked out version, so I think we've gone through most of the... Okay. We have our forwarding for our first two instructions. And then after that, when the fetch stage is next free, that's when I fetch my fourth instruction here, the move into memory. And we need to get the value of R9 for that. And also, we need to get the value of RBX for that. And if we're kind of doing the naive thing, we might say, that like we've done before, we might say, okay, let's just... That means I need to delay this decode so I can get the value of R9, and I'll also get the value of RBX. We can use this trick here, which is that we don't actually need the value of R9 until the memory stage, because we're not computing any arithmetic on it, we're just sending it to the data cache. So I could do forwarding something like this, for example, where I forward the value of RBX to make sure we can add 8 in RBX to compute the memory address to send to the data cache. And I later forward the value of R9 that we want to write to the data cache. And avoid extra stalling. If we didn't have that sort of forwarding after decode, we need to have an extra cycle of stalling here. And then I have my final instruction, move RCX into R9, which doesn't need any forwarding because we're overwriting R9. We don't care what its prior value is. Question?
When do you know when to stall at the fetch stage and when to stall at the decode stage?
When do we know when to stall at the fetch stage and when to stall at the decode stage? So to some extent, this is something a processor designer can make choices about. Usually, I'm showing us stalling at the decode stage because the assumption is, in the fetch stage, we won't have figured out that we need to stall. for the second instruction here, right? To know that we need to stall, we need to compare register number 9 and register number 9. We can't do that until we've read the instructions. As for why are we delaying the fetch stage, well, that's just because I can't have my instruction advance from fetch to decode if decode's busy. Right? Does that make sense? Because you can only have one instruction in decode, and if I'm deciding to hold back instruction 2, I can't put instruction 3 in there. And so that's what's happening here. And so this is not the only way to choose exactly when to stall, but I think it's the kind of probably the most common idea, and that's because we're figuring out that we need to stall when we're about to do the operation, which in this case is get the register values, right? We need to compare the register values for the execute, and at that point we realize, oh, we don't have them, and we stall them. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is kind of idea of pipeline processors. And this sort of scenario where we have some cases where we need to stall, and even so, our forwarding gotten pretty complicated, kind of shows kind of that these pipeline processors have some pretty serious limits. So we're going to next talk about kind of what modern desktop, laptop, mobile phone processors do to kind of get beyond these limitations. Now, we talked about pipelining, even though they don't just use pipelining, because the techniques they use are based on adding extra stuff to pipelining. But there's kind of two things that modern sort of high-performance processors add to pipelining that we haven't seen here. So one of them is that we had this notion that we had just we could only have one instruction being fetched at a time, and that meant, you know, we had to wait until the previous instruction was fetched. And we could only have one instruction reading its registers at a time, and that meant we had to wait till the previous one does. So one thing that kind of modern processors do is that they extend the logic to be able to fetch, decode, and execute, and sometimes do data cache operations for and write back multiple instructions at a time. This means that if we're doing this in the most straightforward way, I've doubled the number of inputs into my register file and the number of outputs, which turns out to be really expensive and really annoying for the ECE people, but it's something that's been considered worth doing, and we also need like 2 ALUs and a fancy data cache. But this is kind of a first way of trying to get beyond the limitations of pipelining, where we end up having stalling more and more as we try to add more stages. Another strategy is to just try to make it so we do 2 things at once. Now, a problem with this that we'll talk about is that this is going to make our hazard handling way more complex, right? We have to think a lot about forwarding and stalling on our one instruction at a time processor. With 2, it's not going to be simpler. The other big thing that modern processors do is that when we would stall, we had this case where we're kind of leaving parts of the processor idle. You know, and that was kind of the whole goal of pipelining, was never to leave parts of the processor idle. But the problem we had is that we were constrained to waiting for this instruction to finish before we could do the next instruction in that same stage. And so modern processors relaxed this restriction and said, when we would do stalling, so like when I have this slow memory access here, let's not, you know, do nothing in that time, because the subtract instruction needs to wait for that memory access, right? We have this big stall here. Instead, let's just keep running the later instructions that don't care about that memory access. So let's let them go through the pipeline. So implementing this requires a pretty different pipeline design. And if we thought the, you know, having two instructions at once is what's going to make it tricky to figure out when we do forwarding and stalling. Boy, does this make that tricky. So we're going to talk about kind of some systematic techniques for designing processors that do this out-of-order execution, which is going to be combined with running multiple instructions at once. And this is kind of how modern processors get good performance and how they get past those limitations where it looks like when we try to have lots of pipeline stages, we end up doing lots of stalling, or if we have data caches like here, which like take 3 cycles, we end up doing lots of stalling. This is our solution for that. So we have these modern CPUs, which are, we're going to execute multiple instructions at once in the same stage. And we're going to execute these instructions out of order, meaning they're not going to be in the order that we kind of would simulate them if we were, you know, sort of tracing the assembly. We're just going to actually do the operations as values are available, but create the illusion that, you know, it's as if they weren't. They were just executing in order as far as like what's computed, right? We're not going to change how the instructions work as far as, you know, the results we get, but we are not going to execute them in kind of the natural way to get better performance, to avoid wasting time not running useful instructions. So, talk about this design, and there's kind of a bunch of problems that wanting to do out-of-order execution is going to create for us. So, one set of problems comes with forwarding. That when we did forwarding so far, we just said, I want to find the most recent version of whatever register value I'm looking for. And the way I did that is I just said, well, you know, I just want to look for the one that's in the last stage. If we're executing instructions out of order, that heuristic no longer works. We need to do extra bookkeeping to figure out, you know, if I have multiple things that are using R9, which is the correct R9 to forward. We also have an issue with writeback that if we're running instructions out of order, we need to make sure we don't get confused because we ran a later instruction that writes R9 and then an earlier one that writes R9. We want to make sure we end up with the later value, not the earlier one. So that's another case where we need to do a bunch of extra bookkeeping. And we're going to have a relatively elegant solution for that bookkeeping we'll call register renaming. So another issue that I'm going to mention, but we're not going to talk about sort of the implementation details much, is with branch prediction. So with branch prediction with our pipeline processor, when we figured out where the whether our guess was correct or not, we sometimes needed to squash instructions. But the operation of squashing those instructions in the pipeline was just stopping instructions that hadn't written any values back yet. That's relatively straightforward. With this out-of-order design, we could have instructions that have gone through almost all their stages by the time we figure out we shouldn't have fetched them. So that's going to make that bookkeeping more difficult. And we'll talk about some of the implications on the software security side of that as kind of our last topic in the class. Another question is, how do we actually sort of implement the choice of what instruction to run next for these processors? And we're going to see that that's going to actually be tied with how we resolve our hazards in terms of choosing forwarding and so on. So let's talk about sort of like what our problems are here. So let's say I have this these 4 instructions here with our 5-stage pipeline. I need to figure out how to get the value of R8 to the last add instruction. And, you know, I have 2 versions I can use, but it's pretty clear because of how assembly works that the one from the move is the best one. And that's going to like take it from execute. That's kind of the earliest in the pipeline we can find something. But with an out-of-order processor, we could imagine having a timeline where because our 10 or our 8's O value wasn't available early, we have to delay actually running the first add instruction. That's something an out-of-order processor might do because, if we had some previous sort of slow memory access that loaded our 10, we would want to run other instructions while waiting for that. But this means that we can't just forward from the execute stage. That's not going to be correct. Also, another annoyance here is that we actually need to keep track of two different versions of R8. Because we need to keep R8 around to write it for this move instruction, and we still need it for the add instruction. So this means that to implement this out-of-order idea, not only do we need more bookkeeping to figure out what the sort of most recent version of a register is, we actually are going to not infrequently need to keep two versions alive and active at the same time. So how are we going to, actually do this bookkeeping? And kind of our idea is that, we have different versions of registers, and kind of the trickiness with figuring them out in this idea is that, all we see is R8. Like, everything's R8. And it'd be really nice if we kind of kept track of, there's different R8s. So let's actually be explicit about that and just write down what the versions of R8 are. And our out-of-order processor designs are going to have this pre-processing step where after we fetch an instruction, we're going to sort of rewrite the instruction to indicate which versions of registers they use, not just which register, not that this instruction uses R8, but this instruction uses version 3 of R8. So for example, if I have this sequence of adds that all adds into R8, I'll rewrite them to indicate exactly what versions of R8 they use. And in doing this, I'm going to always indicate the version we read and the version we write separately. So I'm going to say if we produce a new value for R8, we read from an old version and write to a new version. And now, forwarding is way simpler because I can just check for in a match on R8 version whatever. If that matches, I forward. If it doesn't match, I don't forward. I don't need to worry about maybe I'll find 5 different R8s because I'm only going to find one R8 version 2 being written. Because note that every time we write R8 in this scheme, we make a new version number. So questions about this idea of sort of annotating our instructions with the version of each register. Okay, and I've shown us adding a version to R8. We're also going to have versions for all the registers in the scheme, and just keeping my slide simpler. And something we'll note is that in addition to needing to worry about multiple versions being active at the same time, we actually need to be able to store multiple versions in the register file to do this out of order execution. So here, I have 3 different kind of values of R8 here that given how I've decided to run these instructions out of order, which could happen because of other things they depend on, so like whatever's happening with R10 and R11, sort of determined that we couldn't actually run the add to using R10 and the move using R11 yet. That means that, you know, we actually need to track multiple values, and if we look here, right, I need to make sure that the final version of R, that the version of R8 when this add actually, you know, runs is this one that it uses, not this one, but we still need that one for the move. So we want to make sure we end up with the newest value in our register file. And if we're tracking versions, our solution to that is that, well, we need to keep copies of multiple versions. And we want to be able to like store them in registers. So we're going to just have a whole bunch of extra registers. So, you know, we're going to, because we need to have these multiple versions in flight and including in instructions that sort of are waiting to read from the register file, we'll just have a register file not just store one version of R8, it will store as many versions of R8 as we need, up to some physical limit, obviously, because our register file is not going to be infinitely big. So we're going to do this version tracking, and we're going to assign each version of a register we see in assembly a new real register. And this idea is called register renaming. And as a sort of concrete example of what I mean by lots of extra registers, the like 5 years ago Intel design has a register file for our general purpose 64-bit registers like RAX, RBX, and so on, with 168 registers per core for 16 registers you see in assembly. So I really mean a lot of extra registers. So this is kind of the idea that kind of modern high-performance processors are based on, and I have kind of a going to talk about this idea of register renaming, where we're going to rename what I'm going to call architectural registers. So these are registers in assembly. We're going to rename those into different physical registers. These are registers in hardware. And this is also going to tie into how do we figure out what instructions to run. Since we have a different physical register for each version of a value, we can tell if the values for an instruction are ready by having one bit saying, is this register ready or not? And that's the information we're going to use to figure out what instruction can I run next, or what instructions need to wait to actually run. And also, because we have these separate register, physical registers, we're going to just compare which physical register number have I assigned to this value, and we'll look for that exact value when we're doing forwarding, and also when we're doing checking for, you know, is this instruction ready to run? So let's go through, I have this very complicated diagram, which I'm going to spend time on, of kind of, this is a notional idea of what a typical modern processor pipeline looks like. So we're still using pipelines here, but this is a pipeline that runs multiple instructions out of order. And from a high-level point of view, we have a first part of the pipeline that is in order. So this is doing bookkeeping, where we're still running kind of the instructions in the order they appear in the program. Then we have this out-of-order part, which is run as values are available. And then we have this in order part, which handles finishing the instructions and making sure all our results are consistent with what we expect as assembly writers who don't know our processor does things in the wrong order. So what's going on in these pipeline stages? So we are fetching an instruction. We have our decode, and in this case, I mean actually decoding, so interpreting sort of opcodes and things like that. I don't mean reading registers. And then we do our register renaming operation. So that pre-processing step where we add the version numbers, that happens sort of as a new extra stage in our pipeline. And then the instructions go into this queue here, where they're waiting to run, and we're going to pick them out of that queue, not in the order they came in, but as their operands are ready. So we have this information about which registers, which versions of architectural registers are ready, and we use that to actually run instructions, read their registers, and then assign them to one of many what we call execution units, so the stuff that does math or does data cache accesses. Then we write the value back to our register file, like with our quote-unquote normal pipeline processor, and we have this extra stage that handles kind of finishing up the instructions and doing bookkeeping, especially related to things like what if we have a branch misprediction? This is where we do the bookkeeping to kind of undo it, for example. So one thing you'll notice here, so go through some of the stages. So one thing I skipped over is I said we like fetch instructions. We're going to fetch multiple instructions at once. And this means that we're actually going to have branch prediction that handles predicting what instructions to fetch before we fetch, fetched even the previous instruction, right? Because we're fetching multiple instructions at once, we need to guess where a jump is to do this efficiently, because we still want to keep fetching new things every cycle. And this is something modern processors do. You might say, how do we figure out there's a jump before we've read the jump? And the answer is they have cache type tables that tell them, last time I read instructions here, there was a jump there. So next time we fetch after that, fetch where we think the jump went last time. And also, because this pipeline is much longer, we're doing lots of instructions at once, it really pays to have good branch prediction, so modern processors devote a lot of resources to branch prediction, which means their branch predictions tend to be pretty good. It also means the branch predictor is a substantial amount of space in the processor. As I mentioned, when we fetch instructions, we do our renaming stage here to actually map from the architectural names to the physical register names, the ones that are going to represent our sort of different versions of registers. And I also say we dispatch instructions here. So that's the term I'm going to use for taking an instruction and putting it in our queue of operations we need to do. So we have all these steps before the instruction's actually ready to do any math or memory accesses. But once it gets in the instruction queue, we're going to sort of check the instructions there, compare them to the registers whose values are ready, and dispatch them, and also update the instructions, the ready information. And I'm going to call actually running the instructions issuing them, and that's where we're actually doing the work for the instructions. We'll call that issuing the instruction. And note that I have when we issue the instructions, I'm assuming at the same time you read their register values or do forwarding for them. This register file, because we want to run multiple instructions at once, is going to have a much higher capacity than ones we're used to. So typically on a modern processor, we'll read six registers at once. Because if we want to handle three instructions at once, that's six registers to read. And then, because we're running multiple instructions at once, we'll have different things that can do math for them. And typically, rather than like duplicating the same ALU multiple times, we'll specialize. We'll say, usually, you aren't running four multiply instructions, so we only need one ALU that can do multiplies, for example. So that's why we have these different paths here. Then we do our write back. And then we have this final sort of commit stage that sort of finalizes the instructions. And this is also what handles kind of an important question. If I'm assigning a new physical register for each version, don't I run out? And the answer would be yes, but we're gonna do the bookkeeping to figure out, oh, I no longer need R8 version 1. Let's free up that register for something else. So we'll talk next time. I think Brad will talk next time about how we actually sort of do the registry naming and the instruction dispatch and sort of what the mechanics of this processor design look like.